Welcome to Human Risk, a podcast dedicated to the understanding of human behavior as a risk. Here's your host, Christian Hunt.
Hello and welcome back to the Human Risk Podcast. On this episode, I'm speaking to someone who is both a cybersecurity expert and a stand-up comedian. And no, I don't mean that one is a job and the other his hobby. My guest, Ian Murphy, combines both, using comedy to make people more aware of cybersecurity risks. I became aware of Ian thanks to the brilliant videos that he posts on social media. Like him, they're funny, irreverent, and engaging. But he's not just someone who produces great content. Underpinning his work are some smart ideas about how we can be better at communicating and influencing human decision-making, which makes him the perfect guest for the Human Risk Podcast. In our discussion, we explore how Ian went from being a semi-professional football player via the British Ministry of Defence and then onto his current work. On the way, you'll get insights from him about growing up in Liverpool and some very frank views about what's wrong with the way many organisations approach mitigating cyber risk. What Ian has to say is just as relevant to other contexts like ethics and compliance. This episode was such a lot of fun to record, and you are going to really enjoy hearing Ian. Before we get to that, two warnings. Firstly, there is a lot of adult language in this episode, all I must stress for very good comedic effect. And secondly, some of the cultural references Ian makes might not make as much sense to you if you're listening from outside the UK. So to help you, I've put links in the show notes to the things that I think you might want to find out more about. Without saying, please enjoy, as you absolutely definitively will. I'm so certain that you can have your money back if you're not 100% satisfied. Here's my conversation with Ian Murphy on cyber, comedy, and communication. Ian, welcome to the Human Risk Podcast.
Bless you. Thanks for having me on.
Listen, it's an absolute thrill to have you because you're someone that I have been following on social media for, take this the right way, a long, long time, feels like decades, probably only a matter of months. But you've got this amazing product that you produce and a really interesting life story. But rather than me telling my listeners about you, can you just give them a quick sort of pen portrait?
I hate talking about myself, right? I know most people kind of love doing that. A little bit of my background, grew up in the 70s and 80s in Liverpool. Was convinced I was going to be a footballer, wasn't quite good enough to be a professional footballer. Said to my careers officer at the time, want to be a professional footballer, laughed in my face. There you go. Talk about diversity and bringing people up the right way, right? Can you imagine that happening today? Oh, you can't do that. I'm so offended. It's like, laughed in my face, then ushered me out the room. Became a mechanic because it was the 80s. There was high unemployment, all of that stuff. Did 4 years in apprenticeship. Blagged my way onto a university course, blagged my way into the Ministry of Defence, worked there for 10 years. I use work as a very loose term. And then found my way into the dot-com bubble, where I ended up working for Symantec for about 5 years. And then for the past 17, 18 years, I've kind of worked for myself because I'm largely unemployable because I have a big scouse gob.
And that's why we love you. And look, it's a fascinating career. And I love this shift from football to tech because it's not a logical path. And I'm betting the career teacher, when they listen to this, is going to be sitting there regretting their initial words or maybe saying, actually, they got it right in the first place. But before we come on to talking about what you do now, you were on a TV show. And I think given the name of this particular podcast, I think I can't really let that go. Can you talk about the experience that you had and what happened to you on that quiz show?
Yeah, of course. So it was about 11 years ago now. It was a TV show called Red or Black, and it was hosted by the lovely Geordie Gior Van den Dek. Still don't know which one's which. And the whole premise of the show was a bunch of different rounds, stupid games with celebrities and things like that. And the outcome of each game was red or black. It was a simple 50-50 choice. Started with 1,000 people selected from an area of the country. So they went around different areas of the country. I was in the southwest. That's not because I was caught burgling a house in the southwest at that time. That's primarily because I now live in Bath, right? So I am I'm a working class lad in the middle class world, and the neighbours absolutely love it. The house prices plummeted when I moved in. But So from that, those 1,000 people, they whittled it down to 8 people. Those 8 people went on a live TV show for an hour. And the culmination of that live TV show was one person was left they got to choose, it was a big roulette wheel, got to choose red or black for £1 million. I got to the final person. I chose red because I'm a Liverpool fan. It came up black, and the rest is history, as they say. In front of, I was the first person to lose. Well, I didn't have it, but the first person to lose out on £1 million live on TV in the UK. There's something historical for you, right?
I love that framing of it where you sort of go, the headline is you loses a million, but you never had it in the first place. And so at the end of the day, you were nowhere, you gained some experience, right? There was an opportunity that passed you by. But I think it's really interesting the way we look at life is sometimes you could write two different headlines here. And one of them is guy has amazing, you know, has fun time on TV show. The other one is lost a million.
Yep. Yep. The latter is more headline grabbing than the first one. Somebody has fun doing stuff. Nobody wants to read that, right? But if you then become a red top journalist, somebody losing £1 million drags people in, you know, so it's quite deliberate to do that for people to go, oh, hang on, here's a story. That person has a story behind that. It's almost like talking about my footballing career where I played at Wembley and lost in the FA Vars final in front of 20,000 people and cried like I was Paul Gascoigne, you know, as a 28-year-old man crying like a little child. But that's not as interesting as oh, I had a great football career for 13 years where I played largely semi-professional with loads. But nobody wants to hear that stuff. They want to hear the tragedy laced with the funny, which I think is where we'll get to eventually when we start talking about comedy, you know?
Right. But I think it's really just an interesting illustration because you seem very relaxed about it, I guess, because it happened and it's like it's an entertaining story. It's part of who you are and your backstory. But you know, as you talk about those sorts of things, I'm really struck that you know, lots of press stories about people are going exactly down that line. And I think that's a really interesting dynamic that fortunately yours was, it was a big amount of money and it could have been life changing in some respects. But it's not, you know, it's not sort of like you'd set up a business and lost that money. It just sort of, you had an opportunity to play a game and it didn't work out for you. But that dynamic of creating negative headlines, how we perceive the world, I think plays into a lot of what we see nowadays in terms of how the press are driving people's perceptions of all sorts of topics.
I think so. I think when you get to real serious topics, you know, and I think you very rarely hear the news at 10, bong, and today somebody had a really good day and they really achieved what they wanted to do because nobody gives a shit, right? Nobody cares. But people should care, right? People should care about the positive stuff. But it's almost like a Jedi mind trick, right? Hate leads to anger. Anger leads to the dark side. It's like negativity leads to viewers. Viewers lead to higher ratings. Higher ratings lead to more sponsorship. So it's that kind of thing that drags people in. And I think ultimately, whilst it brings people in, it can also put people off as well. So if you look back at, say, things like Brexit, you know, that negative approach of, oh, it's going to be terrible and the economy is going to crash and this is going to happen, whereas the other side was going to be great, we're going to take our rules back. And whether that's true or not doesn't really matter. It kind of played to a narrative that people wanted the idea that they were in control and it brought that back, you know? So I think there's pros and cons on either side of it. And then funnily enough, 2 or 3 years later on, we seem to be in an economic slump. We seem to be in a, you know, it's like, and then all those clowns who are like, yeah, we'll take our laws back. They're like, yeah, it's not our fault. It's not our fault, Gov. We
it wasn't me, right?
We never did it. Yeah, yeah. It's them over there. It's them bloody Russians over there.
Right. You talked about grabbing people's attention. And the way I came across you is you do these amazing videos on LinkedIn, which are, I think, just both super engaging, but also sort of pushing the limits slightly of the format in terms of, you know, this is a professional. So you're not unprofessional, but you're also pushing the boundaries of what's out there. Can you talk a little bit about what you do and how you go about putting those together?
Yeah, I think I've always found that. So let's go back a bit. I've been in security, cyber, IT security, whatever you want to call it, for about 30 years now, since about 92. So almost 30 years. It's 2022 now. There you go. That's what Liverpool Comprehensive Education gives you, right? And I think I've found in my time that there's so many, I've come across so many serious people who want to be professional all the time. And then you go out with a pint with them afterwards. And it's like somebody's let the fucking kids out of the room and giving them like E-numbers are like, yeah, quick, let's go here. Let's get on the carrier. And I'm like, you're not like that at all in work. So this is your true self out of work. And I wanted to portray what people could expect from me if they ever met me and had a drink with me, right? Because I wanted them, obviously it's amplified, but I wanted them to understand that I'm that same person with everything stripped away. And also, when I see people in the awareness industry now trying to be really serious and trying to get people's engagement and but almost doing it from a negative perspective. So they'll talk about people as users. So there's only the IT software industry and the drugs industry that talk about their customers as users, right? And there's a reason for that, right? So and then they'll blame them for breaches. 90% of all breaches are down to the human. I'm like, no shit, Sherlock. It should be 100%, unless that other 10% is dark matter or squirrels, right? It should be 100%. We're all idiots, right? And then I hear people calling us the weakest link. Now, if I hear that again, and if I'm in your company, not yours, but anybody listening to this, and you call the humans the weakest link, get ready for a kick in the bollocks or a punch in the face, right? Because it really winds me up. It's almost like in the industry, we're some special kind of being that is immune to being tricked and that everybody else isn't and that they're the idiots. We are, newsflash for everybody here, whatever your religious denomination is or whatever it is, we are mammals who've evolved over time. And about 70,000 years ago, we had the curse of consciousness foisted upon us, right? And I love the theory. The only theory I love about gaining consciousness is the magic mushroom theory, by the way. I love that. I love the idea that we got consciousness because we were off our tits on mushrooms. That would be brilliant, right? That would be brilliant if that was. So the idea of consciousness and the idea of to think of myths like religion, like money, and all those type of things, and what made us the dominant species on Earth, anthropologically speaking, right? So the idea that we're all kind of different or some are better than others is just it's just a falsehood, you know? And I get wound up by people calling us the weakest thing. I had one CISO on an event say that he called his people wet sacks of meat. Well, now we know what the C for CISO stands for, right? And I get that people want to do it to be controversial. I really do get it that they want to do it to be controversial. It has to come from a place of kindness. And again, we'll probably talk about this, about offense and comedy a little bit later on. And it has to punch up, not down, right? And I always think that when we do that, we distance ourselves from the people that we've been put in their charge, right? We're not in charge of. Simon Sinek says it. I'm not a big motivational speaker, as you can guess, but Simon Sinek says it, you know, leaders are not in charge of people that people are put in their charge. So it's trying to protect them. And I think the more disservice we do, the more distance we create. And that's why I think humor is a bridge builder. I'll be honest with you. If I ask for people, who was the best teacher at school? So they never say, oh, the one that was quite disciplinarian or the one that made my life hell or the one that battered us all the time. Now, like I said, I grew up in the 70s and 80s and battering kids was an Olympic sport, right? Our schools seemed to excel in sadists. It was unbelievable. Sadists as teachers, mostly games teachers, admittedly, right. You know. But I remember the funny ones. I remember the ones that made lessons interesting. You know, there was a French teacher, Mr. Pritchard. There was a music teacher, Mr. Vaughan. And they kind of made stuff interesting, right? And I thought, look, it's not a brainwave. It's not backed by science. But if I can bring humour to a really dull industry like cybersecurity, I'm kind of starting from a very low base, right? I'm probably the only one doing it. So I've got half a chance of making a name for myself and educating and engaging people as we go along. It's a rather long answer to your question there.
No, it's a great answer to the question because I'm always struck. You're absolutely right about teachers.
And it is funny how PE seems to attract sadists, right? That we really shouldn't be allowing these sorts of, you know, not very good at handling kids. Oh, great. Yeah, let's make you a teacher, right? And yet the ones that were brilliant were the ones that didn't teach to the syllabus. They were interested in getting you passionate about the subject.
Yeah.
Who brought, you know, who literally went off at tangents to grab your attention.
Yeah.
And we'll get through the syllabus brackets if we can, right? But we're here to enthuse you about my subject. And I it's fascinating because at the time, intuitively, you kind of know which classes you like and what inspires you. But it's only later on, I think I look back and I just go, oh, wow, they were really good and they weren't.
Yeah.
And it's for exactly those reasons. It's a sort of understanding of humans. It's recognizing that if you want to get through to people, shouting at them, lecturing them, boring them doesn't do it. And so I think your point around comedy, it's a really simple way of engaging people's brains because it works on a human level. And so almost the more serious the topic, right, the more you want your kids to be enthused by your subject, the more you want somebody to pay attention to what you're saying, the more you have to be kind of more human and probably less serious.
Yeah, I agree. Here's a story from school. This actually happened. This is true, right? We were having a rugby lesson. Picture the scene, right? I went to an all boys school, 30 Scousers, right? About 14, 15, in a field, a rainy field in Liverpool with a teacher trying to teach us rugby. Now, Liverpool is the furthest that you can get away from a rugby city at possible, right? It's just pure football. We just want to play football. So the teacher's trying to teach us how to pass the ball behind us, run round, link and pick it up and move forward. We arsed it up. We arsed it up like no tomorrow. And we were fucking about as well, right? To be quite honest, we were. He stopped the lesson. He got us in the dressing rooms, 30 kids. And he proceeded to throw the rugby ball individually at each of us, like some American quarterback, by the way, launching it as a projectile, bouncing it off our heads to try and get us to learn. And we were all giggling. It was stupid. But could you imagine teachers doing that now? This was the type of way that how not to engage kids. I would dare say if he made a game out of it, if he introduced football, if he played to his audience, he might have got a better response than us taking the piss religiously, right? So that is a true story.
But I love that, right? You will like this sport because I'm going to tell you to. It's a complete, I mean, it's. I think it's incredibly lazy. But it's also just, it's utterly ineffective. And so it's the sort of worst combinations of sort of zero effort put in, maximal output the wrong way, right? You have not won anyone over in that situation. In fact, you've turned them off. And so I wouldn't be at all surprised if all that did was basically fuel the passion for one, dicking around, as you say, but two, it's like, well, this is why we like football. We don't like this other weird thing. And so you're literally turning people away from the very thing you're supposed to be encouraging them to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I will tell you about the time I was in the cricket net as well. Can you imagine giving cricket balls to Scousers? What's that going to do? Right? The dentistry bills were astronomical.
And this, actually, while we're on that subject, I'm fascinated. So Scousers, and for overseas listeners who haven't picked this up, Scousers is a word for people from Liverpool.
Yeah.
There's a sort of reputation, I think justifiable, but tell me if this is wrong, for sort of mischief.
Yeah, for being light-fingered, let's say, if we're going to put it polite. So during the 80s and the early 90s, the comedian Harry Enfield came out with a Scouser sketch. So Scousers, for those outside, is based on a dish called Scouse. It's from the Scandinavian dish of lobscouse, which is potatoes and vegetables and whatever raggedy ass meat you've got available, right? You put it in a pot, you make it all, pot of Scouse. That's because Liverpool was a seafaring town way back when, and that's where the thing comes from. It was a cheap dish to make. It was a fairly rundown area, and that's where Scousers come from. So essentially, in the 90s with Harry Enfield, he came out with a stereotypical sketch on what Scousers were and about being light-fingered, being a little bit dodgy, a little bit criminal kind of fraternity and all that, and having a perm and a shell suit, wearing a shell suit as well. And that kind of thing stuck. I still get it today, right? I still get people when they find out I'm a Scouser, they want to tell me their favourite Scouse joke, right? Which is, if people have never heard it, what you call a Scouse in a suit? And the answer is the accused. So that's the idea. That gives you an idea of the background of... If I hear that once more, by the way, I'm going to go absolutely. It's a good job I have no AK-47s in my reach, because I'm sure. But can you change Scouser to an ethnic minority, yeah, or a religion or stuff like that? Now, can you imagine getting away with that joke? Yeah, people still do it. I still go to Liverpool games, right? And I still hear people sing. I heard it the other night at the United game, people sing and sign on. This is people from Manchester, which is 30 miles down the M62 from Liverpool. We're in the same area. We're almost the same people. We're separated by 30 miles of motorway. Sing and sign on. And if people don't know what sign on is, about signing on for benefits and things like that. I think to myself, when are the working classes going to realise we're all in this together, right? We're all in this. I get the rivalry, I get the piss taken, I get all of that type of stuff. I really, really do get it. I still scratch my head at it, you know, when we get other teams coming to Anfield singing it from Newcastle, from the Midlands, from other Northwest, even from London boroughs and things like that. I think to myself, when are we going to get past this type of stuff? When are we going to be a little bit more together? And if we are then a little bit more together, we can hold those clowns into account in the government that makes such decisions that are so weighted in their own favour. You know, it's almost like they know they can play us off against each other, you know, when we keep doing that stuff.
Right.
Got a little bit Ben Elton political there. Didn't mean to.
No, but I think it is interesting because it talks to sort of sowing division. And sort of othering, and let's blame someone else, and I think that is a prevalent narrative, but plays into exactly, you know, the start point that you came into that with is this idea of how do we react to other people, yeah, and how are we engaging with each other, and how our perceptions of the world color the way we look at things, and so stereotypes, I think, is a really interesting example of sort of it's lazy. It's very simple. There may be a degree of truth, or there was once upon a time, or it's a trope that's been passed down. You know, it's not formed on actual views of people in the here and now. It's a theoretical, lazy kind of analysis of people. And I think that is what we also see, back to your day job, in terms of the way, how do we think about people? Oh, well, they're all idiots. All these people, we have the perfect IT system that's designed, and it's only the idiots letting us down. Yeah. It's almost a similar sort of logic. It's very primitive analysis of not thinking about people as people, but let's just have this homogenized block of something that we can easily, and if we can entertain ourselves by being slightly abusive, then that's a, you know, helpful,
yes,
side effect.
I agree. And you see it in, I think sometimes when people in security moan about the fact that security aren't being listened to, it's almost like we've shot ourselves in the foot, because for years we've said no to things. We've said, you can't do that. You know, for years we said, you can't work at home, you can't do all of that stuff. And then the pandemic hit. So it was a necessity to work from home then. Otherwise, businesses would have collapsed, so on and so forth. Cats and dogs living together, absolute mayhem, right? So, but now we find out that actually you can do a lot of things that you couldn't do previously. You just need the right set of circumstances for it. And I make the joke, right? I make the joke that we never get invited to parties because we are the branch of the company that likes to say no. And I also make the point that actually, if we want to get invited to those parties, maybe it's down to us to cross the road and speak the language of the people on the other side of the road, rather than be the typical Brit abroad that wears the Union Jack shorts, shouts louder, and adds O to the end of everything.
So true. So true. But that's interesting, because that's similar. You know, a lot of listeners to this show work in compliance. And that's a similar dynamic, right? Which is where people just go, oh God, it's those guys, the business prevention unit, right? Who, like, you go and ask for permission, something, the default presumption is they're going to say no. And I think the traditional view of compliance, for very good reason, is that they're imposing restrictions on people and forcing training on people because they can, right? So the primacy is, we need to get the organization to be compliant. So we've decided how we're going to do that, and you're just going to have to suck this up. And I think the same is true of the sort of IT piece, which is kind of, we've designed a system and this is what it will do, and we've designed it for our own convenience. So we don't want people undertaking renegade activities like working outside the office, because that poses a problem for us. More work on our side ruins, yep, our beautifully created system. Ditto, you know, we don't want you taking on new business in the compliance perspective because that's going to generate more risk. So it's almost like the tail is wagging the dog.
Yeah.
And actually, yep, what we should be doing is turning around and saying, okay, right? You might not like the fact that you have people in your business because they're a pain in the butt, but they're necessary to generate revenue because you're not in this function that you're in. So we need to unleash those people to be able to do what they want. And clearly there'll be limitations. There will be stuff that the business wouldn't want them to do. But generally speaking, we're there to facilitate that. And we have to then find ways to work with that. So if those people are under lots of pressure, if they have a moment of idiocy, if they don't actually understand the technical subject that we're dealing with, that's our problem, not theirs.
I agree. And so I'll jump to find a different way to explain it. It's one of the things I get levied when I talk to customers about using my videos and stuff like that. And they're like, but what about measuring change? What about doing phishing tests, for argument's sake, because that's what compliance calls for? And I'm like, so I'm taking a big deep breath here, right? So I'm trying not to get really, really ranty. But I will say this, and I'll say it for all the cheap seats, phishing tests does not eradicate phishing, right? If anything, it destroys more trust with your users because the potential for it to be used in a very, very bad way, and we've all seen those things that have hit the news headlines, just erodes that trust straight away. And even if you're not using it in a bad way, if you get somebody, then you send them an email and they click on that link and it takes them to a site saying, don't worry, just a phishing test. They feel tricked and they feel humiliated, right? So you're already invoking negative emotions with that stuff. I'm not saying it can't be useful, but there's loads of studies that show that it actually does not improve the propensity to click on links, right? So my point to people is, look at the engagement I get on LinkedIn, right? Hundreds of thousands of likes, tens of thousands of comments, millions of views. Look at that and look at the engagement that's coming from those type of videos. We actually, you're asking nothing more from somebody than a minute and a half of their time, a minute and a half to entertain them and educate them, right? And I have people come to me all the time saying, I showed my nan your video. She's downloaded a password manager. I'm like, that's brilliant. That is absolutely brilliant. You know, or my wife has finally changed her password, or my... I do this for the likes of my dad, who are not technically savvy. So when I put out my password post last week around how to select the password, and it's part of my stand-up routine of using swear words and somebody who annoys you at work. And then I get people from the industry saying, what about password managers? I'm like, I fucking know about password managers. It's not for you, dickhead. It's for people who aren't technically savvy, you prick. Read the post. You know, it's almost like I want to reach through the screen and shake them. Stop fucking putting technology in your ticket. It's not about that. It's about making it easier for people. You know, this is on your audio. Christine can see me on video. I've got veins popping out my head and everything, you know, whilst I'm doing it. But I slightly do that tongue in cheek because it's true. People think that tech can solve loads of things. I'm not interested in that side of it, right? I'm not interested in boxes being ticked. I'm interested in the outcomes. And I think we get the equation of awareness wrong. I think people train people to protect the business. Wrong. Absolutely wrong. Here's a newsflash for business owners. People don't give a shit about your business. They really don't. They give a shit about getting a salary and going on holiday to Spain twice a year, right? That's all they care about, paying the bills. They don't care about your business because they know as soon as your business is in trouble, you will have no qualms about cutting staff, right? So there's very few businesses in this world that actually do really care about their staff. Very few. And if the business owner comes on and goes, yeah, we do. We care about our staff. If it's not your employees talking about how you care about them, it matters not a jot what you're saying. You might as well say is we have an office on the moon. It's just, it doesn't really matter, right? So the equation is asked about face. If you change that equation too, we want to give people stuff that entertains them and educates them and will help them and their wider network of family and friends, because they'll take it away and show other people and say, how good is this? How blah, blah, blah. You've got half a chance of making them a bit more cyber savvy. And that should be the goal in this. It should not be creating more layers of human-based technology to protect your business. And if I hear human firewall once more, take firewall out of that term and put shield, and then go and look at what a human shield is and see if that still resonates for you, you gang of pricks. Leo.
That's brilliant. Wow, so much in there, but I love it because what I love about it is you're passionate about it, and yeah, it's ranty and it's exciting, yeah, and all those things, right? And it's engaging. But underpinning it, you've got a really good point here, and I love that idea that on the one hand, you know, with employees, there's this sort of presumption that the employer's interest and the employee's interest are 100% aligned.
Yeah.
Right. And yet in many organizations, we have clear evidence, you know, redundancy rounds,
yeah,
or just generally like making me sit through a tedious bit of training does not illustrate that you give a damn about me.
Yeah.
So let's stop pretending. And I think it's a much smarter move to just go, let's not think about how we would like people to behave. In an ideal world, we have all of our employees love coming to work and they can think that, and they would never dream of going working anywhere else because it's the best company on the planet, blah, 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 because we're amazing. Right. In reality, that's not true. People have all sorts of other things going on in their heads. And for a million reasons, not least ones created by the organization, there are these conflicts of interest. There are going to be times where you want me to do stuff that I wouldn't do. You're going to make my life harder.
Yeah.
You're going to require me to do things I wouldn't do naturally. And so we have to recognize that. And I think there's a lot of sort of fantasy land thinking about, well, if we just point to the employment contract, you know, they have to do this, because then we're missing that human touch. And they, you know, if fine, if you can monitor it, they will pretend to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But actually what's interesting about the phishing stuff is the reason that people know that they want to do that is they know that human beings are fallible.
Yeah.
So if you thought you had it all under control, you wouldn't bother with those phishing tests because you go, we got it all under control. We know that.
Yeah.
You're doing it to sort of prove a point.
Yeah. 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 You're proving what's already there. You know, I think I'll say common sense sometimes, but actually I want to ban that from the lexicon because common sense is just not a thing, right? What I find common sense, what other people find common sense, are two different things. If common sense was universal constant, we wouldn't have to have on coffee cups, caution, hot contents, right? We'd pick the cup up and our sensors would go, oh, that's a little bit hot. I'd better not pour it on myself, right?
Well, so, well, I'd better not drive at high speed down the motorway and stick it in my crotch, which I think was the original story.
Yeah. Or peanut butter jars that say may contain nuts. Think the clue. Is it in the title? It's got nuts on the title.
It's almost like if it didn't contain nuts, something would be wrong, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, so... So I want common sense to be removed. Also, as well, on the phishing test, I give a couple of analogies, right? So
sorry.
So that's my watch wanting to get in on the thing. So
yeah, the chat.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't understand you, you scouse dickhead. So on the phishing thing, I give a couple of examples, right? My parents never taught me that the stove was hot and not to put my hand on it by taking my fingertip and popping it on the stove. I'm burning the tip of my finger to show me how much it hurts, right? So that's kind of what happened. Or they never explained stranger danger to me, right? By employing a stranger to come and pick me up from school, drive me round a little bit, ruin the rest of my life that I'd have to be in therapy, then drop me back off at home to my mum with my mum waiting there and going, now, what are the three things that you didn't spot about that stranger? Just doesn't happen. So why do we think we can do that in awareness? It's just crazy. It really is.
The other bit I love is always, I always used to use those phishing tests as the perfect excuse for any time a piece of bureaucratic nonsense came out of wherever. I would just, because they developed a button where you could click if it's phishing email. So yep. It's quite a smart behavioral thing. This looks suspicious and it would get rid of it. And I think it blocked all the links when we clicked get rid of it. I used to, anything that came in that looked like bullshit, right? Even if I knew damn well it was legit, I'm like, perfect, right? You've just given me the perfect covers. Off it goes. And guess what? 80% of it never came back. And the 20%, I was like, but this didn't look serious. I mean, if this was a problem, this looked like a phishing thing. This is awfully worded. No serious function. This organization will be putting people through this sort of nonsense.
Yeah.
So it was like, it was just the perfect illustration. But I think it's just because we can means we will, right? Oh, what's the easiest way to test these things? Let's just send emails and prove that it's not us, it's them.
Yeah.
Rather than actually, as you talk about, engaging the individuals and just thinking, okay, how can we work with people and with the weaknesses and idiocies and frankly, other pressures? They've got other interests. I mean, I always talk about compliance in this context and saying, look, if people are interested in compliance, right, they'd be working in compliance. I'd argue if you were interested in password managers and IT security as your primary thing, right, you'd be working in that function, not in sales or whatever else.
Yeah. Why do we feel the need to have to explain what we do as well in cyber? Why do we feel the need to explain and justify our existence? Accounts don't do it, right? Accounts don't do it. They don't. Here's how you do double entry bookkeeping. Couldn't really give a shit. Not interested. You know, here's what two-factor authentication is. Actually, if it was easy enough for the user to use it, you wouldn't have to explain it to go, oh yeah, that's second nature. I know about that. Technology companies do a lot better. 4 out of 10 must try harder. It's like a school report. Easily distracted. Ian is easily distracted by the other clowns in the class. Must try harder. That should be the same for every technology company here that we have today, right?
But I mean, that's a great point, because if you look at what are the best gadgets, they're the ones you don't need to read the instruction manual
Correct.
For.
Right? Correct.
They don't even come with them. Like the iPhone, for example, love it or hate it. Right? Yep. Generally, you can make it work.
Yeah.
Right. And you might want to look up a particular feature, but it's deliberately designed so you, out of the box, you can get it to do what you need to do.
Yep. I agree. And you know, I use password managers and all that stuff. Some of it is complicated to me, right? And I've used Vi in the past. I used to code in BASIC back in the day, right? From those magazines where you get the computer and it had one mistake in it halfway down. So you'd spend all night doing it and you'd find out a semicolon was missing and you'd batter your brother for it kind of thing.
This.
What's going on with the... So I'm not a technophobe at all, far from it. I used to configure all those security devices. I don't now because I'm really windswept and interested and I've got other people to do that shit. But I, you know, if we took security technology and we applied the user experience that the likes of Apple and Samsung and all, mainly Apple and Bose, right? I've got Bose earphones in. I've got Apple Mac stuff. If you want to sponsor me, get on the phone. I'm quite cheap, right? You never know.
You've got to try, right?
You never know there's presents on the offering, right? But technology companies need to be better at that stuff. If I asked to send my dad to Open University to learn how to use another piece of software that isn't intuitive to him, it's going to be no good. He's going to resort to the old stuff he did and the old practices he did and the password book he may or may not have. Again, I've seen several posts on LinkedIn about password books. How terrible is this? I'm like, come on, you bunch of dickheads. Think about it outside of that little realm that you're in. It might be terrible for you in security because you've been fed a bunch of Kool-Aid of password and two-factor and multi-factor and blah, blah, blah. For an old-age pensioner who just wants to store their access to Hotmail and stuff like that and they can't remember it and all of that stuff, it's a useful thing and the risk is really low of somebody breaking into their, maybe not as low in Liverpool, but of somebody breaking into their house... and stealing that book and then ransacking their bank account for the £4.70 they've got in it, you know? So it's like, let's try and remove ourselves from the comfort blanket we've got and the ivory tower that we all live in. Get amongst the people who we should be caring a little bit more about and talk their language instead of coming back to my earlier point, instead of pointing fingers and laughing from the outside.
But I mean, that's so fundamentally simple. And the bit I find interesting is if you look at things from a customer perspective, right, there are certain things organizations get their employees to do that you would never dream of getting a customer to do. Well, we couldn't possibly do that because they won't do business with us.
Yeah.
And I don't understand. I mean, some companies are awful at customer service. Let's be clear about that as well. And they might be good internally. But we know good customer service when we see it in the outside world, right? If someone pisses us off, we don't go back to their business. Someone rips us off, we don't go back. If it's an unpleasant experience, we don't go back. Restaurant that almost poisons me ain't going to get my business again.
Yeah,
certain kebab shops at 3 o'clock in the morning accepted, where I may have forgotten.
Now, they're not quite experience. A restaurant, are they? If you're classing them as a restaurant, we need to have a chat.
Right. No, this is... Well, although McDonald's is technically a restaurant, according to its own definition, so...
It's got tables and chairs, that works for me.
This is true. But so we know this intuitively, that unpleasant things that don't work with us, we've steer away from them, and so we're put off. Yep. And the bit I find fascinating about that is there doesn't seem to be a benchmark that says what's the employee experience like. You know, HR will talk about the employee journey, a little bit like those TV talent shows. Everybody has to have a journey. But it's you know, that we think about those sorts of things, but we don't say, well, what is this doing to their day-to-day existence? Is this pissing them off? Is this wasting their time? And I think we should be putting that customer lens that says, well, we don't want to irritate our customers, we want to retain our customers. The same thing to employees, particularly where they're working in remote environments where changing jobs is, particularly with the labour market where it is now, it's much easier than ever before in some cases. And, you know, if switching jobs involves you log into the same laptop at the same desk, it's just a different employer, even easier. We need to be working with that dynamic. And so being less irritating and less intrusive seems to me to be critical.
I can, but don't forget, if you ask an employee for their feedback or honest feedback on something, they're not going to give you their honest feedback. The same as you're not going to be the person you are outside of work, in work, right? I've lost count of the number of HR meetings I've had, right, to be quite honest, because I am generally, if you speak to anybody who's ever worked with me, I'm the same person in work, right?
Right.
I don't pull any airs and graces. It's not that I don't suffer fools gladly. I'm just the same person. Some people like me, some people don't. I'm all right with that. I'm not out to win any beauty contests, right? Or popularity contests. I'm there to do a job and I'm there to do it well. I don't intentionally go out to upset people. Just seems I have a God-given gift for it, though. I honestly, on my post yesterday where I did the A to Z rap or the A to Z rap, the Z because it was an American type of rap, but the A to Z rap, somebody wrote on my post, and I kind of leave them there. I don't sanitize any of my posts. Somebody wrote, "You looks like shit." I'm thinking, that'll do for me. That's going on the testimonial wall. You know, apropos of nothing, I haven't even had a chance to insult this person, but it seems I have a gift for people to, and it's only one or two people that ever come on my post and have a go at me like that, you know, but employees will generally not give you the truth. If you ask for it, they will not give you the truth. That's why one-to-one should be banned in every company. They should be banned. They're useless. The only use of one-to-ones is to get a promotion. And actually then it's a popularity contest if your boss likes you or not, because you'd be doing a really shit job if your boss likes you. You'll get, I've known football teams, by the way, who've kept certain professional footballers on and extended their contracts because they're good for the dressing room. They're not good on the pitch, but they're good right. for the dressing room. And that says a lot as well, you know, because you need that type of stuff. You need the hard workers. You need that. But you also need the office clown, right? You don't need the office self-appointed clown who thinks they're it. You don't need the David Brent clown, right? You don't need that person. You know, he went home to get his guitar. Fucking, you don't need that. Or the person who's, and I get it now, being a stand-up comedian, I get it. I'm funny. I've had people come up to me and go, "I'm funnier than you." Almost like there's a news out of Boys from the Black stuff, gives a job type of thing. People come up to me and go, "I'm funnier than you." And I'm like, "Congratulations, well done." You know, which comedy clubs have you played at? "Oh, I don't do stand-up." "Oh, okay, fair enough." Or the phrase every comedian dreads, "Here's one for you." I'm like, no, I don't think so. No, it's not funny. Why isn't it funny? Because it's racist and it's homophobic and it's this and it's that. I get people telling me those jokes. You can use this one. I went, "I'm only going to use that if I want to get cancelled, to be quite honest. I'm not using it." "What's wrong with it?" "Well, where do you want me to start?" You know, it's like, honestly. But
that's a weird thing, right? Because you wouldn't like go to a restaurant and go to Gordon Ramsay or whoever. Right? You try this recipe, mate. It's much better than yours. So why is it acceptable to do that to you in that context?
Absolutely. I don't know. I mean, I'm quite good about it. I just, you know, I mean, I was at the Fringe last week and I annoyed John Bishop for a bit, right? Who's a hero of mine. And we actually have a past, and I reminded him of that past. So we played football together for a very short period of time, very short indeed. And he didn't remember it. And why would he? Because, you know, I didn't have a beard and glasses then. But then we had a laugh about it, right? You know, so I would never dream of going up to John and going, "What about this joke, John? That's blah, blah, blah," you know. And because it was just, you're right, it's almost like going up to Gordon and going, I think I've got a beans on toast recipe that you'd really love. It's like, "Yeah, I'm all right. And I'm good. No, I'm all right. The secret is pepper. I don't care what your secret is. I'm just not interested in it, you know?" But it's nice that people actually take the time out and take the effort to come and do it. But just be aware, if you're listening to this and you ever approach me with a joke, I'll politely laugh and go, "Oh, that's really good." And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, "Don't ever come near me again. If you come near me again, I'm going to find a shallow grave to bury you in."
love that. And I think the comedy piece is interesting because it's entirely consistent with your approach to the cyber stuff. But it's also a fascinating way of developing a model for engaging people. So I'm imagining you do it because you enjoy it and you're clearly good at engaging people. But I presume it's a nice virtuous circle, and it helps fuel the work product.
I'll tell you why I did it. Because the videos themselves, so it's something I've always wanted to do. It's been hidden in me for a very, very long time. And I turned 50 and I thought, now or never, why not?
So, yeah, if not now, then when, right?
Yeah. So it's probably...
It's a great midlife crisis to have, though, isn't it? I mean, that's brilliant. That's right.
It's a wonderful one, isn't it? People have affairs or get sports cars or whatever. I just make a dickhead of myself on stage. So so my wife is kind of cool with it, you know, I'm not. And it gets me out from under their feet, so she doesn't have to listen to my rubbish jokes. But the reason I did, apart from always wanting to do it, is the videos is a collaborative process, right? The videos are a collaborative process with my team, who are really a great bunch of creatives. And I'm more or less the Morecambe and Wise in front of the camera, where they're the Eddie Brayburn at the back of the camera, writing the stuff, sitting down, we'll sit down, we'll go through it, here's what we're going to do, or I'll come up with an idea, and then... So it's more of a collaborative process. The stand-up comedy was something I wanted to do that was mine and mine alone. Almost to prove to myself that I think I am funny, but not so much to get validation, because actually when I do a show, people will come up afterwards and really give me really good feedback and validation. I think, oh, you're just being kind. So I can't take the validation that people come up afterwards and go, that was really good. It was really, and I'm thinking, well, you're just being kind because I'm here. And they'll go, no, that was really, and I'm like, okay. But, and even at the back of my mind, I'll still go away and think, that joke didn't land quite right. Why didn't that? I'm quite critical of the stuff I do. You know, that didn't land well. Why didn't it land well? Could I do something different? And things like that. I suppose that's a good trait to have. But I'd also like to be a little bit more satisfied in it as well, right? You know, because people do find it interesting. People do find it funny. I do a podcast with a mate of mine who is an established stand-up comedian, you know, and I overheard him saying the other week at the Fringe, he's a really good comic. He's really natural. And I'm like, yeah, he's a bit drunk. He's not talking about me there, you know? So it's that kind of, I mean, maybe it's not imposter syndrome. I don't have any kind of syndrome. Shove that syndrome up your ass, right? I do not want any kind of syndrome or any kind of excuse for it. I think it's just my Scouts upbringing, where we were taught to accept kindness very well. We were taught to accept kindness with a sarcastic, piss-taking attitude, right?
Right. Yeah, and it's strikes me, you're talking about sort of work in progress, right? So you talk about the outcome you're looking for, to be more satisfied. And I wonder whether, is that actually ever achievable? Because presumably you're just building up this set of things. Okay, a joke will work well, but there'll be something else in the set that didn't. And so you're naturally, as we always do, right, you'll focus on the ones that didn't quite land the way you wanted them to land. And so my sense is that like with writing or anything else, right, you could always be better, and you know you could always be better. And so in many respects, the curse is it's a constant kind of work in progress, and you'll never quite get there because you're never going to stop adding new material.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's what drives people on. That's maybe what stops it being stale, right? That you're always achieving. I don't think I'm achieving, I want to achieve perfection. I don't think that's possible, right? Because things move on all the time. Social attitudes move on, all of that type of stuff. So I don't think you can achieve perfection. But I think I just generally want to get better at it. Even when I was at football, I wanted to get better. I was more critical of myself playing. I would remember the bits I didn't do right in the game rather than the bits I did, you know, or the goal is good or whatever. I'd remember the other bits that I didn't do quite right. I got outpaced. I was on the wrong side and I thought all of that type of stuff. So I was a bit more critical. And I didn't have the greatest talent as a footballer. I had enough talent that I got paid and got paid handsomely for as a semi-professional footballer, but I didn't have enough to make it as a full-time role. You know, I played for Bury for a little bit for their reserves. I've been on several professional contracts in the semi-professional game, but that was kind of the closest I've gone. So I guess I achieved what many thousands of kids never ever get any close to, anywhere near. But it wasn't quite my ultimate dream, and maybe that's the bit that drives me, because I was always nervous before a game. Always, didn't matter. I played thousands of games. Doesn't matter how many games I played, and I played them in front of nobody. And I played them in front of 20,000, always got nervous. It's the same with comedy. I always get nervous. Same with presentations as well, by the way, because I do a lot of keynotes as well, but I do a different type of keynote. I do a keynote where I mix this message that we're talking about now about awareness and fun, but with some of the stand-up bits and routines. So I never use any slides because I think they become a crutch that you rely on. And if you're going to say what's on the slide, yeah, just let people read that, right? Instead of...
Just, I can read for myself.
Have a look. Is there any blind people in today? If not, knock yourselves out and read it. I'll print it out in Braille.
I'll be at the bar.
Come and see me afterwards if you've got any questions. Don't give it an hour or two. I might be a little bit shit-faced at that time. You might get the answers that you want. I always wonder about that, right? I always wonder about people who have 10,000 slides as well. You can't say it in 10 slides. You shouldn't be saying it at all, right? It should be a course or stuff like that. It should. So I knocked the slides on the head ages ago. And I kind of do that more irreverent keynote. I talk about human beings. I talk about our propensity for idiocy. I talk about why that is. I talk about why we'll always fall for scams, why it's always been the same, whether it's today or 250,000 years ago on the savannah of Africa and things like that. There's always been people who want to steal your berries, right? Always. It's the same today. Doesn't matter whether it's on the savannah or in the ether somewhere. There's criminals everywhere. There's always been bad people. And there's always been idiots amongst us. And we're all those type of idiots. Just give it enough time and you'll come across your own idiocy, you know? So I think that's really important for me. It's really important for me to try and be that genuine self. And actually, it means that each keynote is different, right? I almost go up there with the same ethos Billy Connolly does as he goes up with a stand-up. I kind of know what I'm going to talk about, but I never know which tangent that I'm going to go off on. I did something recently for a customer and I got away with a cunnilingus joke, right? Who knew if you'd get away with a cunnilingus joke in front of a room full of CISOs? You know, it's like, but that's where my mind took me there. And it just seemed natural to do. It wasn't offensive. It wasn't misogynistic or anything like that. If anything, it was highlighting the propensity we have in our industry to get things wrong, you know, and to misunderstand what the normal person on the street wants to think about. And I think that's when I say cybersecurity is dual, welcome to the antidote. I think that's what I mean in the antidote. I'm the normal person, as normal as you can get, person on the street. I think I like to try and represent that. You know, the quiet majority that are listening to somebody talk about zero trust and thinking, what's this fucking idiot going on about?
But there's something interesting there around, you know, letting, for you've got a rough route map of where you'll go and you've got material that you can lean on, but you're kind of reading the room, right? And some of it will be driven by what you feel like on the day. How do you get the best out of yourself? But a lot of it is also, I'm guessing, reading the room and seeing, you know, just how are the reactions and where does that take me? And I think that's another really good illustration of the thing that is missing from a lot of these kind of quote unquote professional communications and education attempts, because it's kind of like, well, we've created a piece of training that will solve that problem. And what you've basically recognized in your, yes, it's different when it's face to face with people and you're getting that particular feedback, but recognizing that that's important, that if you misjudge the mood of the room, the content can be amazing, but it's going to bomb. And so you have to adapt to that. And I think there's something interesting in that, particularly where we are communicating with people digitally. Mm. Right. We have options now to give people content that will be more resonant for them. So there are going to be people that are more attracted to content A. Some people want a bit more detail. Some people just want to laugh. Okay. Some people. And we have the opportunity to do that. And I think sometimes training and communications and these sorts of things don't think in those terms. Right. Sure. It's kind of like job done. Yeah. I have concocted something I think is perfect. And there's no sense of reading the room in the way that you do.
And that's why I always say to people, you know, training, awareness, whatever it is, needs to be layered. I almost go like Shrek onions layered, you know, and it really does need to be layered. And I'm not saying that my approach is the right approach, but I'm saying if you do want to do fishing training, knock yourself out. I don't think it's useful, but you knock yourself out if you do. But there's still space for my content over the top because you've got more chance of capturing a wider swathe of your employee estate than just focusing on one. It's almost like saying, I love lasagna. I'm only going to have lasagna for the rest of my life, right? You know, so unless you're Garfield, that's not working for anybody, right? So you need variety, and you need that different approach, and you need those different things. It's why I actually developed that keynote speak and also the stand-up, is to offer people in October Awareness Month a different approach to awareness, right? Let's have a little bit of fun about it. Let's poke fun at ourselves. Let's be the butt of the joke for once, and instead of trying to make the users, I hate using that term, but the employees the butt of the joke, let them have a laugh at us, you know? And I think that exposing that kind of idiocy within the industry and that terrible thinking is the right way to go within it, you know? And I also think, like I say, try different things. It's why essentially, because I'm still a startup, right? I'm still new and unique doing this type of thing, even though I've been a dickhead for all my life, right? For as long as I can remember, I've been a dickhead. So I'm really adept at it. But as far as the cyber community exists, you know, it's been a couple of years, 18 months maybe, that I've been building up this persona. And then for the past 6 to 9 months about doing stand-up and things like that. So I get that people are fearful of it because it's new and they don't want to take my word for it. They'd rather see a doctor or a professor stand up and talk about behavioral science and how it works and how it changes cultures. Listen, I don't need Professor Brian Cox to explain to me the calculation for gravity and that if I step off a really tall building, I'm going to end up in a squishy mess on the floor. I already understand that, right? The same as I already understand humor is a massive, massive tool for learning. It really is a massive tool for learning. And what's the worst that can happen? When people go, oh, I don't know if I can do that because Karen and Dave might get a little bit offended. Are you willing to accept the risk of the 99% of your employees falling foul for a scam because of Karen and Dave? You know, are we limiting our company because one or two people may take offense at something that is not offensive at all? They're just either taking offense on other people's behalf, or they're asking me to do something about an emotional reaction they've had to one of my videos if I might say nob in it. You know, it's like, I can't, right. Because the other thing I was going to say about digital is context is always missing, right? I did chat on this week's post. So I did a post about hating Daniel Radcliffe, right? Let's for the record say, I do not hate Daniel Radcliffe. I've never met the guy. I'm sure he's a lovely, lovely guy. But it built up to the point in the post because he did the Blackalicious A to Z rap on Jimmy Fallon, and it was awesome. It was brilliant, Danny, right? And I'd made the post about hating him because he was so good, and I'm going to get my own back by doing my own version of the rap. Some bloke wrote on my, and he deleted the comment afterwards after I pointed out the ridiculousness of it. Some bloke said, I enjoyed the spoof of the video, but I don't think attacking Daniel Radcliffe is the right thing to do because blah, 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 and you've missed the point here. You've let yourself down. And my response was, have you got out on the wrong side of sense of humour bed this morning? If you can tell that the A to Z rap is a spoof, do I really need to add emojis, smiley emojis, or only joking at the end of my post to alert you to the fact that this is a spoof? You know, go and be no fun someplace else. He deleted it once I put it on there, right? A couple of other people saw it. But, you know, this, I think that, but for him, context was missing. And I get that. And, you know, and I tried to make it lighthearted. I wasn't trying to attack him. I was trying to make it lighthearted to get him to rethink what he wrote. And I hope he did, because he then deleted it because he probably saw the ridiculousness of what he was saying. You know, I'd hate to feel as if I'd offended somebody deliberately, right? If you're going out with the intention to offend, you're an arsehole. I've said this before and I've said it many times. You're an arsehole. It's really easy to do. It's not a nice thing. If somebody takes offense from somebody, something I've done, there's not a lot I can do about that because it's your emotional reaction to it. As long as I know that the subject of the joke is either me or an institution or a thing or a celebrity or a politician, or because then it becomes spoof and parody, then I'm kind of okay with that. If I'm picking on somebody and I'm getting all my followers to pile on, that's not good. That's bad juju, right? That's not good at all. And I would quite rightly be called a prick by everybody for that.
that plays into, we were talking about before we were recording, the whole kind of cancel culture. And there was a comedian at this year's Fringe, Jerry Sadovitz, who had his show cancelled because people found it offensive. And so I wonder, I mean, that you've pointed toward, almost what you're saying is there are no limits because you would, you're calibrating your output and you know where you're coming from. And so you're prepared to run that risk of offending people because actually it's you've thought about it before. It's, you're not just sort of blundering out and shooting from the hip. There is some thought behind it, and therefore that's the calibration there. Is that the right way to look at it?
Yeah, I think so. There's always thought behind it, right? There's thought behind the jokes. There's thought behind the videos. I think it's easy to offend, right? If I wanted to offend, I'd pick a person or a societal group or whatever, and I'd go after them, right? I'd go after them. I'd like to think that any joke I do or any joke that I have a personal connection to, right? So if I'm going to do a joke about a vegan, I've got a personal connection to it, right? Because of stuff that happens in my life. Or if I'm going to do a joke about being a Scouse, well, I'm a Scouse, I can do that joke, right? Or if I'm going to do a joke about dementia, I can get away with it because my mum had dementia before she passed away. So I can do that stuff because it's personal to me, right? If I'm doing it to pick on somebody and to go after it, then I think that's wrong. That's the bit where you're punching down. That's wrong. That's just bullying. That's another thing as well. Bullying. I think most of the time now it's easy to hide that, oh, you're just being bullying and stuff like that on online. And I'm not saying it's not a thing. Of course it's a thing. And if somebody's mental health is affected by it, then we need to take it seriously. But I sometimes wonder how a lot of these people that instantly, when they don't hear something they like, pull out the bullying card, how they'd have gone on at my school. I sometimes wonder how during the 80s, when actually, if you walked into school with the wrong haircut, you got battered, right? And I'm not saying that's right. I'm not saying it's right. But I worry for the next generation of people, for their resilience at things. And I think that's where part of what I do in reacting to kindness, of being a bit sarcastic and piss-takey, that's a double-edged sword, right? Because I do say thanks, but inwardly I'm like, oh, I don't know how to react to it. I wonder if that kind of approach of being able to take the piss out of yourself and have fun against yourself and own sometimes the insults that are being directed to you, that we're anesthetizing life so much where at some point it's just going to be too boring to live. It will be too boring to live. You know, I don't mean to be outspoken for outspoken's sake, but I think I should. I think I should cause discussion amongst people. I think I should be either likable or not likable. Because if I'm trying to please everybody, I'm pleasing no one, right? So if I'm trying to please in my mind the normal person on the street, my dad, my brother, my wife, my son, all of those people, if I'm trying to please those people, I know where my audience is and I know who it is. If then somebody who I'm not trying to please gets bent out of shape, I don't know, the owner of a fishing company or stuff like that, or the owner, I really couldn't care because that's not the target audience I was going for. And I wasn't meant to offend you anyway. I'm going there. So I think you should pick a niche. I think you should pick a niche and go after it. Because otherwise, if you're trying to appease everybody, you're just going to fail, and you're going to fail consistently at it, you know?
Wow. I could go on and talk forever, but time has beaten us, Ian. I'm now struggling to know what to say, because normally I would say, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I love your stuff and all those sorts of things. But given the way you said you react to it, I will just go, I'm going to put links to all of your things in the show notes, including some of the videos that I have particularly enjoyed, so that people can get hold of you. Because I think what I do find really fascinating is, yes, you're talking to a specific audience, but it definitely resonates with a much broader audience of people that are trying to persuade individuals within an organization to behave in a particular way, solve this human risk challenge. And I love the fact that you're sitting there going, look, we just have to accept people do stupid stuff and let's work with that rather than against it. And the fact that you use comedy, I think, is fabulous. So I will say, I do love your work. You've been an absolutely fabulous guest on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being here.
So that's it for this episode of the Human Risk Podcast. My enormous thanks to Ian for appearing and to you for listening. To find out more about Ian, his work and his videos, have a look in the show notes. There are links to all of those there. You'll also find links to some of the subjects that we talk about so you can explore them in more detail. If this is your first time listening to the Human Risk Podcast, where have you been? Welcome. You can subscribe wherever you get your quality audio content. It's available on all of the major podcasting platforms. To find out more about me and the work that I do with my clients, helping them to mitigate their human risk, visit human-risk.com. I'll be back very soon with another episode of this show, but in the meantime, stay safe. Remember that comedy is a very powerful communications tool, and thanks for listening.